A rare, deadly disease that leaves patients in critical condition and doctors searching for answers. Knowing the signs can save a life. This is Investigating HLH, a podcast about hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis brought to you by Sobi, Inc.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the third episode of Investigating HLH. I'm your host, Adam Narlock, a thought leader liaison for Sobi Incorporated. In this series, we ask experts in the field to help us explore various topics surrounding the diagnosis and management of hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis, also known as HLH. This episode is called Treating HLH. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Sara Caviani and Dr. Blachi Davia about the goals, strategies, and challenges involved in HLH treatment. Dr. Sara Caviani is a pediatric hematologist-oncologist and assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Chicago Medicine. And Dr. Davia is a pediatric hematologist-oncologist and associate professor of pediatrics at George Washington University. Dr. Caviani and Dr. Davia both have published extensive research exploring the mechanisms and management approaches for HLH, and they will walk us through their insights on HLH treatment. All right, well, welcome Dr. Caviani and Dr. Davia. I'm so glad to have you both with us here today. So if you'd like, just tell us a little bit more about yourselves and your experiences with HLH and really how you came to be someone who sees these types of patients in your practice. Dr. Caviani, we'll start with you.
Perfect. I was going to say, I'll go first because we know I like to talk. So I was formally trained in my hematology-oncology fellowship at Vanderbilt. And with the mentorship that I had there, really grew to love non-malignant transplant, immune disorders, immune deficiencies, and actually took an immunology class with the allergy and immunology fellows and learned all about immune disorders, which I had no training in, and we don't get that as oncologists. And then stayed as a bone marrow transplanter there for a couple of years as kind of early faculty. And I've made my way back up to Chicago, where I had previously trained. And now I'm at University of Chicago as the clinical director of the transplant program here, which really means I get to pick and choose who I want to transplant. And I really only choose the non-malignant and immune disorder patients, which is a win all around. But I have really pivoted all of my academic and research endeavors in that world because I just love these patients so much. And I think that the people in this community, including who I'm looking at right now, and Blachi and all of the leaders that have walked this field, is it's such a tight-knit community and we all learn from each other all the time. And I'm constantly emailing, hey, what do I do with this? Or how are we going to treat this patient? And it's everyone is so receptive and open to sharing their experiences. So an opportunity like this is like a full circle moment to kind of talk about things that we obviously love to talk about.
Dr. Davia?
Blachi, your turn.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I actually had a very similar upbringing, if you will. I did hematology oncology training as well. And then I did my transplant training at Cincinnati Children's. I was exposed to a lot of non-malignant transplant there, primarily immune deficiencies and HLH. And that really sort of made me very, very interested in this field. And so I've sort of catered everything after that to sort of focus on my research and my clinical energy in this patient population. So I moved after Cincinnati to DC, to Children's National, and I'm the head of the non-malignant transplant program there, which is mostly clinically and research focused on primary immunodeficiencies. I also had the primary immunodeficiencies clinic there. So it's a combined clinic with immunology and us to see patients like this. And then, of course, we do a good amount of research endeavors on this field as well. I think it's a fascinating field where we're learning a lot every day, but there's also still a lot to learn. And I think, like Sarah's saying, the collaborative spirit of the field is also a great benefit to it that always drives us back to it.
So fascinating. You know, I just want to thank you both, honestly, for your dedication to the specialty and to treating these rare patients with these diseases like HLH. And I'd like to start off really talking about the overall goal in treating patients with HLH. So the literature suggests that the first goal, you could call it the main goal, of HLH treatment is to subdue the life-threatening inflammation that's really driving the disease. So if you could talk a little bit about why this goal is so important, and if there are any other additional objectives that should be considered when treating these patients with HLH. Dr. Davia?
Sure. So I think it's an important question. We all know there's a lot of very severe hyperinflammation in HLH, and that has a lot of different components to it. I think one of the most important things to discuss is that you get very severe organ damage from this inflammation, right? And so trying to control that inflammation as early as you can is very important for those organs to be in the best possible shape that it can be. And so that's very important because in the long run, you are going to need to do all sorts of different treatments to sort of ultimately cure the patient of HLH. And so the better shape all of the patient's organs are going into further treatments, that sort of definitely helps in terms of the long-term outcome of the patient. I think, as you well say, there's also a lot of data to suggest that calming down the inflammation is also very important to make sure that your treatment is ultimately successful. Because we know that, say, for example, if we're going to talk about stem cell transplant, trying to go into a stem cell transplant with a very severely inflamed niche will predispose you to a lot of issues, not only in terms of organ damage, but also in terms of rejection and other things that ultimately hit your patient outcome. So yeah, I definitely agree. Controlling inflammation as best we can is key to success.
Yeah, I think one of the, to kind of echo what Blashie just said, one of the key things that I describe to families or residents or trainees as we're talking about this is these patients, when we think about the spectrum of how on their immune system is, they're hot. Like they are incredibly inflamed. And anything we throw at them is to cool them down. And the reason we need to cool that immune system down to normal values and normal levels and normal function is we cannot get them to that curative outcome, which is going to be the transplant, if they are still hot. We know that whatever we do to try to cure them in that moment is potentially going to just go awry. So really the goal first is to kind of calm the storm, keep everything at bay. And I think the second piece of that that's really challenging that we don't talk about in these patients out loud, but we all are aware, is twofold. One, all the organ damage that he is talking about is directly then going to affect what therapeutic measures we can use on these patients. When we think about classic measures of how we used to treat HLH 20, 30 years ago, and you know, still to this day is the mainstay, and I'm using quotes for the purpose of saying that we can do better, is that those agents that we use are directly toxic to the same organs that we're saying are inflamed. So it's often this very constant loop of damage that we're seeing. And the second piece of that is we want to keep them alive to be able to transplant them. I mean, to be quite frank, that's what it comes down to. And if we are trying to cool an inflamed immune system, that means also preventing them from getting life-threatening infections and some of the complications that we can see from the disease itself, as well as our own interventions. So I think that's one of the challenges of HLH is you have a patient who's incredibly ill and who without control has the potential to be even more ill. But then how do we as the provider step in and make the best decisions that limit that window of, okay, well, this is where the most damage is going to occur. This is where the most toxicity is going to occur. Do we have safe options to kind of provide this patient to cool them and get them to where we need to be? Because without that, we know that it's just going to be like, you're pedaling, but you're not going anywhere.
Hey.
Did you like that analogy, Blashie? Pedaling, not going anywhere?
wholeheartedly. But I think you're right? And also one of the challenges is, as you're saying, the toxicity can sort of jump on top of the things that have already gone bad. And then so sometimes you worry, what's going on here? Is this still active HLH? Is this a side effect of my treatment? And it is a very challenging scenario that you sometimes have to face, because obviously we all want to do what's best for the patient. And so you want to attempt to minimize that toxicity, but make sure that you control things as best you can.
Truly fascinating listening to you both discuss this. I'd like to dive a little bit more specifically into what you both mentioned around this ultimate goal therapeutically of treating HLH is this transplant, this hematopoietic stem cell transplant therapy, also known as HSCT. And you both mentioned in your training that you were trained in bone marrow transplantation. So this has evolved a lot over time. Could you walk us through a little bit of the process that you touched on just briefly of HSCT and how it might affect certain patients differently and all those things that are involved in that?
I can take this one.
Go ahead, Dr. Caviani.
So I think as we think about what we're trying to accomplish with a bone marrow transplant or a hematopoietic cell transplant or stem cell transplant is we're trying to replace a defective bone marrow and a defective immune system. And with HLH patients, we're really primarily seeing the defective immune system component, but ultimately those two go hand in hand. And when we think about how we take a patient to transplant, the first step is we're going to be working as hard as possible to control that inflammation. That's going to be kind of ongoing as we're driving the car forward towards transplant. And then in parallel, we're working that patient up. We are finding a donor option for them, and we're seeing kind of what outside of family members, what is in the registry through the NMDP, what options we have that are safe for the patient. And we're doing everything we can to preserve from further organ damage, further inflammatory complications, and infectious complications in the patient. And then the process of transplant itself means that that patient is going to receive chemotherapy at doses that is going to make space in their body, make space in their bone marrow, make space in their immune system that then allows for those donor cells to come into their body and take place where we want them to. They find their niche, so to speak. And the process of the transplant actually for the patient is really anticlimactic. I feel like we talk about bone marrow transplant like we're surgeons, but we're not surgeons. We're not that cool. And it actually just goes through the patient like a blood transfusion. So I always say that to families because I feel like it's portrayed that it's a big surgery for the patient. But really, if you're receiving the cells, it's just going through your body like a blood transfusion. And then those cells, they are attracted to the spots in your body that they need to go to. It's really incredible, actually. And they go there and they start to grow. And they grow to the point where you hopefully post-transplant are going to have a brand new immune system. And that immune system hopefully is going to have the proper checks and balances where you are not going to get those huge bursts of inflammation, where you're going to be able to come in contact with everyday things and not have your immune system go completely awry as we see in our patients with HLH. And that's often the challenge that they face. So really the process of transplant itself, going through it, it's life-changing, but it does require a lot of care for the patient, the family, and I always say the family around them, brothers, sisters, caregivers. It's a huge deal. You know, we do a lot of it in the hospital, the process of the chemotherapy, the cell infusion, waiting for those cells to grow to the point where we feel it's safe to go home. It's usually about 6 to 8 weeks in the hospital at least. But even when you go home, it's not easy. It's being careful, minimizing sick contacts, staying on medications that are calming your immune system for many months after. You essentially go back to an immune system of a newborn baby. So your shots are essentially inactive in your body. You have to start from scratch. And in that comes a lot of care and, quite frankly, stress on caregivers. But we feel comfortable doing this. We can guide families through this. We do this every day for lots of different conditions. And it has proven to be our most successful at curing HLH and diseases like that. So as daunting as it is, just know that there's a whole network, a whole team of providers that feel really, really comfortable in walking you and your family and anyone that you know that's going through this process.
Absolutely. I would add, you know, talking specifically about HLH, primary HLH, if you will, at the same time, we're trying to calm down the inflammation. We're also trying to figure out what is driving that inflammation. And so in patients with primary HLH specifically, we know that there's this problem, this genetic problem, this condition you're born with in which your cells can't really clear one particular trigger, and that trigger can vary a lot depending on the patient. I would say infection is the most common, but not necessarily the only one. And so if you have this HLH-type phenomenon and you have one of these genetic predispositions to it, we know that this is going to be a very high risk scenario for this to continue to happen. And that's really where the stem cell transplant comes in. Because as Sarah is mentioning, we essentially replace the body's marrow with a new marrow. We don't just change white cells, we change the marrow and the ability of that marrow to make everything, right?
We sound so powerful.
So it changes all your stem cells. It's true. And so that you will make blood and red blood cells and platelets and white blood cells of the donor. But of course, the main thing is we need to find a donor whose cells have the ability to control this inflammation so that you're not continuing to be predisposed to these things. And so really, that's the main goal of doing the whole procedure, is sort of making sure that these events don't ever happen again. And we'll also say that process that Sarah describes has changed quite dramatically over the 2 or 3 decades that we've been doing this transplant. I think we've been able to fine-tune things a lot better and try to strike a good balance between getting those cells in, but minimizing the risks to the patient, because ultimately we all are in this together for the same goal, which is a good outcome for the patient.
Thank you both.
Yeah, I think something that comes up with families is, do we have to do the transplant if we're controlling the inflammation with medications, et cetera? Why do we need to do this last piece? And I think I describe everything else that we've done leading into the transplant as putting a Band-Aid, trying to control the bleeding. But ultimately, we need to go in and actually repair the problem that exists. And without that, we know that there's a potential for relapses of HLH and the potential for your organs to not be able to rebound at one point. You know, if we let that inflammation keep going on and on, we know that patients' bodies will not handle that and they will eventually shut down. And that's the exact opposite of what we want. We want to take patients when they're as healthy as possible so that we can get them again to a healthy state post-transplant.
So much going on in all of this. Thank you both so much for that great information and just those thoughts and your passion and your love for what you do. It just comes through so clearly. One thing you both made very, very clear is that treating HLH is a very complex process. There's multiple factors involved, lots to take into consideration. So as a disease that drives such widespread inflammation through, as we mentioned, multiple organ systems, I've also read in the literature, obviously suggests that initial treatment approaches for patients with HLH often consists of a wide variety of generalized immunosuppressive therapies. So I'd love to get your thoughts on this. What initial treatment approaches do you normally take to address that widespread hyperinflammation that we talked about prior to talking about transplantation? Dr. Caviani?
It's a great question, Adam, and it's kind of, I want to say, even more complex if we can make that possible. But I think to speak to something Blasi said earlier in terms of we've gotten better at treating, we've gotten better at transplanting, I will say we've gotten better at recognizing HLH, which I think is first and foremost. Catching these patients early is key. And then deciding kind of our diagnostic workup, I think that for the most part, there are really nice and well-respected algorithms for how we should work these patients up. And I say that because a lot of the testing that we do can be affected by a lot of our interventions. So diagnosing kind of requires early recognition and then sending up all the labs that we really care about seeing to kind of navigate the next steps and to solidify our diagnosis. And then as we've done that, I think the backbone for most kind of initial approach is steroids is one piece. And I think steroids, they're easy accessible in terms of when we think about institutions across that need to stabilize their patient quickly and access to drug. But we often forget about the toxicities that come with steroids. So for me, the steroid piece, I always am thinking, what's the fastest I can get my patient off steroids ultimately? But steroids are really the first piece that we use. And the traditional backbone of HLH therapy was using a medication, a chemotherapy agent called etoposide. And the way that I describe it is it's not chemotherapy that's anti-HLH, right? The only reason it works and we've seen success is really because it wipes out your immune system. It wipes out your T cells, which are a certain cell in your immune system that is responsible for a lot of the inflammation that we see in HLH. It gets rid of those. And so by getting rid of those, you're decreasing the inflammation, but it's temporary and it doesn't come without significant toxicity. One of the biggest toxicities that we see with etoposide is it can cause lots of damage to the liver. And guess what? The liver is one of the most inflamed organs in patients with HLH. So it's this double-edged sword of what do we do? And I think in the immunoheme, in the immune disorder, autoinflammatory world, and world of HLH, most of us are trying to move away from that and to not add toxicity to the backbone of our patients and to really focus on more targeted therapies. There has been so much advancement in that field of being able to use newer agents that are so much safer and so much more tolerated, well tolerated. And we know, we've demonstrated with those newer targeted agents that we can take patients to transplant at a higher success rate. And that's really the goal here. We want a cure. So really, I urge anyone who takes care of an HLH patient to really start thinking outside of that traditional kind of HLH backbone of steroids and chemotherapy and start to look into the use of the targeted agents that are available. And there's so much more success in the outcomes of those patients, in their organ status, in their risk of infection, as opposed to just continuing to throw toxic agents at them and ultimately potentially deterring from the goal of taking them to transplant.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think we know that the inflammation in primary HLH is primarily driven by those cytotoxic cells, your T cells and your NK cells. And that's why historically, as Sarah mentioned, steroids and etoposide have been the way to go, because both of these are very lymphotoxic and they're very aggressive ways of eliminating those T cells and therefore bringing down the inflammation that those T cells are causing. But as Sarah was mentioning before, it's kind of abandoned because you still have the cells that have that defect. So you still need to get to the other end of that. And so we have many, many years of experience with steroids and etoposide, and because they calm down the cytotoxic defect, they can calm down the inflammation. And so I think we're all very comfortable using them, but absolutely, they definitely come with a cost. And particularly in this condition, these are not things that you can do for a very short term and then everything will be okay, right? You'll need to continue some sort of treatment in order to make sure that the inflammation becomes stable. And that's really where you can run into a lot of the issues that Sarah is discussing. So yeah, I fully agree that we are now able to dive really deeply into what is driving the inflammation, not just the one cell, but what pathway, what protein. And so targeting those things a little bit more directly can definitely minimize the amount of toxicity that we give the patients.
Thank you both for sharing all of these thoughts. Obviously, it's extremely complicated. There's a lot going on. It's been widely recognized that there's all of these toxicity risks associated with these kind of, we'll call them broad spectrum approaches, such as the immunochemotherapies you mentioned, specifically one of them being myelosuppression. And then obviously there's a generalized immunosuppression taking place in these patients when you use these types of agents. Could you tell us a little bit more about those risks in particular and why it's sort of important to consider that myelosuppression and this generalized immunosuppression when you're treating these types of patients with HLH? Dr. Davila?
Yeah, I think that's one of the problems that Sarah and I were alluding to at the beginning in terms of, is it the disease, is it the toxicity, is it the egg or the chicken type of situation? Because the severe cytokine storm that you get in HLH can cause severe cytopenia. So most of these patients are usually going to come in with very low counts. But then, of course, the chemotherapy that we use, in particular the etoposide, can also be very myelosuppressive. So then you have a disease where your counts are down because of the inflammation, but you're using medication to calm down that inflammation that can sometimes worsen this cytopenia. And so then you run into that problem of, my patient has low counts. Do they have low counts because they still have active disease, or do they have low counts because I am going a little bit too heavy with my etoposide? And so that's why looking at just that can become very complicated. It sort of makes you have to look at the whole picture of the patient and the inflammatory pathways and see where you are. Because of course, if this is secondary to the treatment that we're doing, then continuing that treatment is going to cause prolonged low periods of counts, and the transfusion needs come with its risk. And then, of course, the very low counts come with its own infection risk as well. And both of these are things that, again, can put you at higher risk of having troubles in the long run, particularly as you head into transplant.
Dr. Caviani?
I think knowing that we just told you that the patients have to stay in the hospital for many weeks going through the transplant process, any time where we can provide some normalcy or like a reset becomes really important for these families. There are patients who receive the primary diagnosis and then stay in the hospital through transplant, but ideally, and I will say that I have seen this in my practice as we've moved towards targeted therapies away from the traditional chemotherapy that can be incredibly toxic to the bone marrow, that can put you at very high infectious risk, that patients usually can go home for at least a little bit before we bring them back in. And that really helps families more than we all realize in that mental state that they're in, just kind of being in this constant back and forth. So I think that's one piece of it. And the other piece is, quite frankly, I think on the provider end, we're terrified of it. Anytime you're sitting with counts that low, anytime you're constantly giving blood and platelet transfusions to a patient, we're only decreasing the probability of getting them to transplant safely. And so if we have methods and agents that we can use that can bypass that, that really becomes ideal for us. And, you know, why not use that approach?
Absolutely. No, I agree. I think transfusion dependency is one of those things that becomes very important to discuss in scenarios like this, because then you have patients where you think the inflammation is down and your patient is looking better, but they're still needing transfusions so persistently that you're not able to spread them out to a place where you feel safely that they can go home. And so, yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I think when we're able to do that, it makes a significant difference, particularly because, as you mentioned before, transplant is quite the long haul. So you want people as prepared for it as possible.
For sure.
Thanks for explaining all of this. You know, it makes sense that there's a need to be mindful of the potential side effects of the treatments in patients who are already experiencing this range of symptoms. I'd like to dive a little bit deeper now into the HLH treatment strategy. It's apparent why broad-acting treatments like the ones we've been discussing and these approaches, that they're used in response to this widespread inflammation in HLH, even though there's risks involved. However, considering the mechanism of disease, which Dr. DeVia, you alluded to a little bit, and Dr. Caviani, you as well, that mechanism of disease, which involves the dysregulation of key cytokines in the patient's immune system, that approach of targeting those certain elements of the disease a little bit more directly. I'd love to hear a little bit more discussion on this and where you think this might be going. Walk us through this just a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, Adam, I think you hit the nail right on the mark. Is we have studied HLH for years, and it's scary. We've studied a lot of mouse models of HLH. All the initial papers were in mice, which who knew they were exactly like us. But we've learned about exactly those proteins. So we talked about your T cells, your macrophages, your NK cells are all part of your immune system that very easily become inflamed initially appropriately to a virus, to something that we come across in the environment. In patients with HLH, essentially that process of turning their immune system on, basically the off switch doesn't work. There's this constant feedback of, hey, we're not inflamed enough, pick up, pick up, pick up. And it creates what we call a cytokine storm, which I love. Like, how amazing does that sound? But in reality, that's where all the toxicity comes from. That cytokine storm, those proteins that are in your bloodstream that shouldn't be at such high levels, those are what's causing toxicity. Your bone marrow, your liver, your brain, all the organs that we have talked about through this session and that we see in real life with our patients. And so if we can go and actually basically dampen those exact molecules and stop them from creating this ongoing process, that would be the key and kind of approach for these patients and would spare them some of the other more classic therapeutic agents. So it's just like in the world of cancer, you know, these chemotherapy drugs we've had for years. And when we think about treating a cancer, there are now so many more agents that we have learned about that target certain cancer mutations or certain types of cancer. It's similar in HLH, is now we can kind of be even more precise in what we're targeting. And hopefully with that targeted approach where we're getting rid of those cytokines that we know are incredibly toxic to the body, we can dampen that and stop that from causing more damage, but minimize the earthquake effect around it, where we're just then focusing all of our energy on that one pathway that we know is so detrimental while minimizing the toxicity around it. And that to me, as somebody who takes care of these patients and whose ultimate goal is to get them to transplant, that is the key. That is how we are going to have success, is how can we do damage control with everything else that we're hitting? And how can we best suit our patients to get them to this endpoint that we keep talking about? Using that mindset of going after a specific target as opposed to just destroying everything, we've gotten so much better. I feel so much more comfortable teaching my trainees and talking to families about our approach for HLH because of agents like that.
Again, we know from years, decades of experience that steroids and etoposide are very helpful in this scenario. So I certainly don't want to take away from that. I do know that they do help. But again, I think in the long run, they definitely are associated with significant toxicities, you know, both long-term exposure to steroids and long-term exposure to the etoposide, as we've discussed. So yes, these things are definitely helpful. But in the long run, if we can figure out ways to start bringing that down and minimizing the amount of those medications that we need, particularly as we head into transplant, that typically helps get all of our organs into better shape and the patient into better shape so that we are in a more successful territory. I love your analogy about the cancer medications, because it's exactly that, you know, it's more about learning that we can manipulate the pathway that is affected so that we can calm down the cancer or calm down the inflammation rather than destroying the whole cells and destroying the function of the organs along with it.
So good. Really is. I love listening to you both speak about this. This has been so much fun. So Dr. Caviani, Dr. Davila, I'd like to thank you both, honestly, for such a thought-provoking, meaningful conversation and leaving us with so much important information to consider about HLH treatment. We've covered multiple goals of treating HLH in this conversation, the risks associated with certain therapies, and then even some of the potential benefits in this more targeted approach to HLH treatment that we've discussed in this episode. So to both of you, do you have any final thoughts that you might like to share with our listeners? Dr. Caviani, I'll start with you.
I think just speaking for both of us, thank you for having us. Thank you for doing this. This is, in the world of rare disorders, this is a rare disorder. I'm not crying. I'm just, you know, aspirating on something. I will cry over HLH though. I think recognition, I think discussions like this, I think continuing to ask the right questions of how can we do better for our patients with HLH? How can we improve their outcomes? How can we help control their inflammation, transplant them more safely and more successfully? Those conversations need to constantly be ongoing. And I think creating a platform where patients can learn more about this, where trainees can learn to recognize this earlier, this is where it all comes down to. And I really thank you for this platform to talk about this. And obviously, I get to see Blotchy, so it's even better. But I think both of us can do this all day. I mean, my fellows think I'm insane because I always say, you know, HLH is my favorite, but it's because of this. And it's because it provides a multidisciplinary approach and it really forces you to be incredibly thoughtful as you're working your patients to the next steps of their treatment plan. So thank you for doing this. And I think both of us are really excited and lucky to be in a field where there's so much thought and there's such a drive to constantly do better for these patients.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think the more we know about these things, then the more we can directly target things, the better we all are for the sake of us and our patients as well. So I do think it is important to make sure when we're dealing with patients with severe inflammation, with patients with HLH, that we do actually look and monitor all these new testings and all these new functions, because ultimately, when a patient comes in very, very sick, they're all very inflamed. There's a lot of different things that can happen, and we're not quite sure there at the beginning where exactly we need to be headed. So I think as we learn about more pathways, we can become a lot more specific in terms of this is actually where the issue is, and we can pinpoint that so that we minimize not only off-target toxicities, but also, you know, off-target treatments and cases when we're not necessarily talking about primary HLH. So for sure, I think that's another important consideration to discuss.
Yeah, definitely.
I just want to thank you both so much for the passion that you pour into this for the sake of your patients, for spending this time with us today. This concludes episode 3 of Investigating HLH. Remember, when it comes to HLH, knowledge is power. So please stay tuned for our next episode where we will learn about a potential treatment option. Thank you. Take care.
This podcast was produced in partnership with Amaze Media Labs.